Good evening again. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. I want to welcome you all to our third call for the NEA BPD Fall Call-In Series. Please do check your email boxes. We've just recently sent you the slides. And for those of you joining us tonight for the first time, this call-in series is one of the ways we are marking our first decade of work and saluting the many hours of free time given by the professionals and families to help the BPD community. Before we start, I do want to let you know about two upcoming events that we have. One is on Friday evening, October 21st, from 6 to 9 p.m., where we have a meet and greet in New York City. The speakers for the evening are Dr. John Oldham, president of the American Psychiatric Association, Dr. Herb Pardes, who is chairman of our scientific advisory board, as well as a past director of the National Institute of Mental Health and the CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital. We also have Dr. Bruce Cuthbert, director of the NIMH Division of Adult Translational Research and Treatment Development, Amanda Wang, a person in recovery, and our speaker tonight, Dr. Stanley, will also be joining us there. We also have a conference in Atlanta on November 4th, one speaker being Randy Krieger, author of Stop Walking on Eggshells, perhaps the book that is most read in the general BPD community. So please go to our website for more information, and please also think of sending us a donation, as we have said over the weeks, that we are so appreciative if you help us to help you. So now for the call, reviewing some housekeeping. Everyone is on mute, so there'll be no background noise during the call. Dr. Stanley will talk for probably about 45 minutes or more, and then we'll throw open the floor for questions. We ask that if you have a question, please send an email to neabpd@aol.com. It's now my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Barbara Stanley, who is a professor of clinical psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University and a research scientist at Psychiatric Institute. She has a clinical practice that specializes in treating individuals with borderline personality disorder and parents of adult and teen children with psychiatric problems. Dr. Stanley's research focus is on interventions, neurobiology, and clinical aspects of suicidal behavior, self-injury, and BPD. And before Dr. Stanley starts, please all again check your email boxes. These slides should be sent to you in a constant contact email. Thank you, and now I turn the floor over to Dr. Stanley. Barbara?
Okay. So is this, can you hear me okay? Is this?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. So first I would like to thank Perry and the NEABPD for inviting me to talk with you this evening. And I would love that if I could hear all of you to know who it is that on a Sunday evening, on a holiday weekend, gets online to hear a talk about something like this. But you guys are very dedicated, so I appreciate your coming online tonight. So what I'm going to talk about for the most part this evening, is an intervention that my colleague Greg Brown from the University of Pennsylvania and I developed for working with suicidal individuals. And it's a one-shot intervention. It's a brief intervention, and I'll explain more about it and how it is that we came to develop this intervention. And then I thought what I would also do is talk, before I get to the intervention itself, I thought I would talk about what my experience is, what I have learned in working with hundreds of people who are suicidal. In my treatment research, they all have borderline personality disorder. In my private practice, virtually all of them also have borderline personality disorder. So I'm going to be talking about this generally with suicidal people, but most of my experience comes from working with people who have BPD. Interestingly, my colleague Greg Brown, who is the co-author of this intervention with me, has worked mostly with depressed individuals, not people with BPD, and he is now working with older men. So this is an intervention that is being used across the board, across diagnoses. But I think it's particularly well suited for individuals with borderline personality disorder. So if you follow along in the slides, I just want to acknowledge my the people who have given me funding, my funding sources. It's NIAAA, NIMH, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the VA. As I mentioned, this intervention that I'm going to talk a lot about was developed with my colleague, Greg Brown. And I have here my email address. If there's something that you want clarity from about from this presentation, of course you can email Perry, but I'm also putting my email address up for you here. Okay, so if we look at the third slide and look at how you can intervene to prevent suicide, and, you know, it always starts out with some kind of individualized risk assessment. And so what I would say is it's a very complicated thing to do a good risk assessment of somebody in the moment. How much at risk are they to commit suicide? It's kind of like, in a certain sense, like the person who goes to the doctor's office, you know, and has a checkup and is not feeling great, and then comes out and has a heart attack, even though the doctor did a full exam. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that individualized risk assessments, as important as they are not foolproof. So whenever we have somebody who has evidence of being suicidal, we always do a safety plan. So this is their kind of this is their safety net. And so even if they're not suicidal in the moment, right then and there, and they need it, they don't need it right then and there, we formulate this with them in the event that they do need it. Okay, so then you have the next step in this way. If we look at trying to prevent suicide, when you have somebody who has suicidality in front of you as a clinician, you have to figure out what to do. Now, you can see on the side there I put these arrows where there is opt-out, you know, these two places. And it's very important to think about that, because there are points at which it's not that we opt out, it's the suicidal person opts out. They come into your office, or they go into the emergency room, and they decide this is not for me, and they're gone. And or we try to engage them in treatment, and we work with them on what are the kind on strategies to enhance their motivation to be in treatment, and they decide no, this is not for me, they're gone. This is particularly important with suicidal people, and I'll come back to why it is that I think that it's important that we pay attention to these places where patients opt out, because they really do when they are suicidal. And then, of course, we have patients, if we can engage them successfully in treatment, then they typically enter some form of individual treatment. We always include safety planning there, and that can be, depending on their level of risk at the moment, either hospitalization or outpatient treatment. So if you go to the next slide, here I talk a little bit about the success of engaging people who are suicidal in treatment. We're not that good at it. And this is not just people who have borderline personality disorder. This is in general. People who are suicidal are a very difficult population to engage in treatment. And so here's some of the data. I won't go through it all, but most suicidal individuals who go to the emergency room for help, so they are extremely acute, attend very few outpatient treatment sessions. Many of them, and I'm sure that if you've ever worked in an emergency room, you know this, many don't even attend one session. I can think of somebody, one example is of I accompanied somebody who was neighbor to the emergency room, a young person who was acutely suicidal. Very, very suicidal in the moment. They decided not to hospitalize him, and he never went into treatment. The emergency, the crisis was gone, and that was that. But it's really important to pay attention to this period of 3 months after a suicide attempt, if somebody comes into the emergency room, it's not a foregone conclusion when they've made a suicide attempt that they will get hospitalized. It's definitely not a foregone conclusion. But so you may have that person in outpatient treatment. And so there is this period of risk for reattempt or suicide death in that very high-risk period in the 3 months following an attempt. So you have this kind of difficult thing where people who are suicidal we have a hard time getting them into treatment, and yet if they have made a suicide attempt, they are extreme risk for making another attempt or committing suicide. Even more difficult are adolescents, who tend to have attitudes naturally that are inconsistent with long-term treatment, and by long-term for adolescents, you're talking about a couple months. If you've lived through your own, having your own adolescence, you know that this is a common mantra. The past is the past. It won't reoccur. And so if they made a suicide attempt, that even if it was 2 days ago, it's in the past. It's not going to happen again. So when their mood improves, it's hard for them to imagine that it could worsen again. In other words, it's a risk for them that they wouldn't go into treatment. Also, individuals with borderline personality disorder, we all know they're extremely high risk for suicide and suicide attempts. They are also difficult to engage and maintain in treatment. And so the point of all of this is to say, when you have somebody in front of you who is suicidal, do something with them more than just doing a risk assessment and a triage, which is what we often do with somebody who is suicidal. And so if you go to the next slide, you see the typical strategy for crisis intervention with somebody who's suicidal is you assess for imminent danger, and then you refer for treatment. And so that can be, if that's somebody in your practice, you assess them and you send them home or you send them to the hospital. But the thing that I think about this is that, right then and there, if you have a person, for example, in the emergency room or in your office as a consultation, that you can do something right then and there to increase their safety. And so that's where the safety planning intervention comes in. So before I talk about the safety planning intervention, I want to talk just a little bit about some of the things that my patients taught me, my research participants taught me about managing suicidal individuals. For me, it's in the context of treatment trials, but I think this holds in the context of any treatment with a suicidal individual. So if you go to the next slide, there was a study that we did at Columbia where we compared DBT to a manualized supportive therapy, and we were recruiting suicidal and self-injuring individuals with borderline personality disorder. I'm not going to go through the results of the study, but I want to just describe what I learned, like why I learned what I learned. So we could see that if you go to the next slide, that DBT was better at repeat suicide attempts. But if you look at the frequency of overall attempts in the study, and this was a year-long trial, in both groups, we did not get a lot of suicide attempts over the year of treatment. And so that started me thinking, what the heck was going on here? And so if you go to the next slide, I went to my data, and I went backwards, and I looked a year back into the number of suicide attempts in the year prior, because I thought, well, maybe because our criteria to enter the study were self-injury or suicidal behavior, I thought, well, maybe we mostly got just self-injurers in, even though I kind of knew that wasn't the case. And so you could see when you look at that, there were a lot of suicide attempts in the year prior to the study, and very few while they were in treatment, irrespective of the condition. And I can tell you that that we had a low-intensity condition where patients got supportive therapy and no medication whatsoever except benzos. So, but we still had very few suicide attempts. So if you look at the next slide, it taught me something about how do you manage suicidal individuals. So because we were doing a research study, we put certain kinds of things in place simply because we were a research study that would be more kinds of monitoring than we would normally do that we would normally do at the time for suicidal patients. And so what I had the people who were my, because I was very concerned about maintaining the safety of our research participants, I had everybody who was treating patients explicitly inquire, whatever treatment they were doing, explicitly inquire each and every time about suicide ideation. Remember, these were all people who came in who had suicide ideation at the beginning. And then I required development of a collaborative plan for managing suicidality each and every time if there was any evidence of suicidality and documentation of that plan. So I had a note, like in my charts for these patients, I had lines that where they actually had to check about the person's suicidality, and if there was any evidence of suicidality, what did they and the patient together figure out was going to happen? And so I think that if, as therapists, we do these two things alone, we will go a long way for decreasing suicidality of our patients, at least while they are in treatment with us. And so from this, I developed, if you go to the next slide, some what I think of like as therapeutic basics. Now, some of these, of course, are very natural to me because I have been trained in DBT, and these come kind of right out of DBT. Although I have to say my colleague Greg Brown is trained in cognitive therapy, and this is perfectly consistent with the approach that he takes. So the therapeutic basics for this population, I think, are as follows. You do ongoing monitoring of suicidality. If there is evidence of some suicidality, you think about, as opposed to keeping the appointments as they are and the contact as they are, if it's once a week, once a week, if it's once every other week, once every other week, that you increase contact and have flexibility in your approach. Now, of course, if you do DBT, you know this is perfectly consistent with that. It's part of the treatment. But it doesn't have to just be part of DBT. It can be part of any treatment. In addition, clinician consultation is incredibly important. We do this all the time, and this is not just within DBT. This is, you know, I'm fortunate to have a great group of colleagues at Columbia, and we're all doing research with suicidal people. And so somebody who is doing medication with somebody who is suicidal will often consult, if they're worried about the person who they're treating, they consult. It's always better to get another opinion. I'll talk a little bit about the therapist's stance in a minute. You do collaborative strategizing with the patient, and I really mean collaborative strategizing. This is the two of you formulate a plan together about what will happen. And then you think about structuring, moving to greater structuring of treatment. Okay, so how do we do ongoing monitoring of suicidality? And this is not just you notice that the person seems in a good mood and they're okay, and so you don't ask about it. This, we do an affirmative assessment of suicide ideation. And then you conduct an affirmative assessment of recent suicidal behavior. And so with our patients refusing to discuss this is not an option. So it's when we work with patients, we don't allow this to not be, well, I don't want to talk about it. Well, so again,
this is something that you develop collaboratively with the patient at the beginning of treatment. You do an affirmative assessment about recent suicidal behavior. And the other thing that's important, especially when you work with patients who have BPD, is even if they don't have suicide ideation, we always ask about suicidal behavior, because they may not be currently suicidal, but if you work with this population enough, you know that sometimes the suicide attempt is, I'll use this in quotes, curative. In other words, the suicide attempt somehow serves a function that seems similar to self-injury for them, in that they feel better afterwards. And so they could come into your office in a reasonable mood, so you wouldn't have any sense that they have suicide ideation, and in fact they may not, but they may have made a suicide attempt 3 days ago. So we always ask about both, and you don't assume that if patients don't express suicide ideation that they are not suicidal. I have had so many patients with borderline personality disorder say, the clinician doesn't care about it, that's why he didn't ask about it, the clinician doesn't want to hear about it, so he or she doesn't have to be at risk to do anything about it, or doesn't have a liability. And so if you don't ask your patient with BPD about it, they often will not tell you. And so the trick here is to create a therapeutic environment that encourages disclosure of this, which means that every single time somebody is suicidal, you can't hop to hospitalize them. Okay, so if you look at the next slide, we talk about increasing contact and having flexibility in your approach. So you can provide, there's a bunch of ways to do this. Provide for increased contact during periods of suicidal crisis by increasing the number of appointments, increasing intersession contact by phone or email. I'm very comfortable with having patients email me if they are comfortable with it. Some people don't like it. Some people don't want it. Some people don't feel it's secure enough. There's another thing that patients seem to feel very comfortable with, which is a patient checking in without the therapist contacting the patient. And that simply is the patient calls and leaves a message saying, I said I would contact, you know, I would check in to let you know how I'm doing. I'm doing okay. Or, you know, I'm struggling, but I'll be all right. And in advance, the therapist and the patient have agreed that the patient is just going to leave a message. And it doesn't mean that the therapist has to get back to them. And that's the kind of a thing that you arrange in advance. And that helps the patient. But that also helps the therapist not worry. Okay, consider options for other forms of therapeutic support. Of course, hospitalization is always an option, but there are others. And one of the ways that I work with patients is we work with them with increasing their daily structure. And this can be in the context of a day program, but it doesn't have to be. And just having people get up and out and not sit at home and have a daily routine that the two of you work out collaboratively can do a lot during periods of suicidality. Okay, so the next slide, clinician consultation and support. When in doubt, consult. That seems very obvious, but we don't always think about that. And also, seek support in all of this. Utilize your colleagues to help stay on track. And as an antidote to hopelessness about the patient. And this, again, comes straight from my training in DBT where I learned that having other people who work with similar kinds of patients to consult with is extraordinarily helpful to maintain a sense of hopefulness about the patients. And the thing that I would say with all of this is that there is nothing that helps the therapist be good like experience. I feel really probably a lot more comfortable letting somebody go home from my office because I've worked with so many of these patients. And if they're expressing suicidality, then I probably take what other people might say is more chances, because to me it's I feel like I'm not taking a chance. I have the base of experience. It's kind of like going to the surgeon who has done this surgery, you know, 500 times as opposed to 10 times. And so the more that you work with this patient population, the better it is for you as a therapist. Okay, the therapist stance. There is a hard balance that has to be achieved. There is a balance. You have to balance concern for the patient without being overly anxious. If the therapist can't tolerate suicidality, we know that the patient gets more frightened. The type of inquiry that we use is a matter of fact but serious. There is a kind of balancing there. The therapist needs to not worry too much, and there is an openness with the patient to the patient about this fact, the therapist has to develop a tolerance for a certain level of suicidality, and balance with a sense of caring about the patient's suicidality, and so. If somebody tells you that they're suicidal, and you let them out of your office, let them leave, that if you don't convey to them a certain kind of sense of caring, they can think that you are giving them permission, or in fact even wanting them to kill themselves. And so there is this kind of tricky thing that has to that you have to develop. And then finally, we take a collaborative problem-solving approach with the patient to managing their own suicide risk. And this is where safety planning comes in. And so we do this kind of collaborative strategizing. You discuss in advance how the two of you will handle suicidal crises. Now, this could be, sometimes patients could think, oh, well, you're just, you're looking at the worst case scenario. I'm not suicidal now, even though I made a suicide attempt a month ago. I'm not suicidal. But it's pretty easy to say, to convince a patient that even if they're not suicidal now, that it's always better to have a plan in place should they get suicidal again. And when I work with adolescents, sometimes they don't really want to do this, and I'll just more or less take a can you kind of just like humor me here and let's develop this plan? I've never had anybody who hasn't been willing to go along with this. And so the safety plan intervention is an emergency plan should somebody become suicidal again. And in my opinion, no suicidal patient should leave an appointment, the first appointment, without a safety plan in place. And so when you have somebody who comes into your office who has made a recent suicide attempt or who is grappling with suicidality, you want to make sure that they are safe to leave your office and go home. So you have to do some risk assessment, and you want to develop some sense of that you have a sense of empathy. You want them to walk away with that. But besides those two things, the next most important thing is to have them have a safety plan when they leave your office. Until I have those three things, I don't do anything about learning about their history or what they want out of therapy. I think that, so that's how important we think that this is. It's different than a no-suicide contract, which are popular but not very useful. No Suicide to Contract asks the patient to stay alive without telling them how to do that. Safety plan intervention actually doesn't ask a person to stay alive, simply gives them coping strategies. And it's pretty simple and straightforward, and you think, well, we all do this, but and there's nothing kind of new with this intervention, because what we did was we actually took pieces of evidence-based treatments, like what are the things that we have as clinicians that we know help patients not commit suicide, not make suicide attempts, and we put them into this one single-page intervention. And that is really, there's a couple things that are about it, but the fact that we have packaged this all together in a simple way is what is unique about it. So if you look at the little diagram, the safety plan intervention, it really has kind of two components. It's to reduce suicide risk and enhance coping. And then secondarily, and I say secondarily because sometimes we don't really even get around to this part because the rest of it takes too long, it's to enhance treatment motivation and linkage. Okay, so if you look at the next slide, this just gives you where we have published this, that we have a publication in Cognitive and Behavioral Practice this year. And then also if you Google safety planning, if you Google safety planning and suicide, this the VA safety planning manual that Greg and I wrote will pop up. Safety planning was designated as a best practice by the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, AFSP Registry of Best Practices, so that there is there's a lot of momentum for this intervention. It's been adopted by the VA nationwide for all high suicide risk veterans, and the next page just gives you an example of what the VA has done with this. Okay, so what is this intervention? It's a hierarchically arranged list of coping strategies for use during a suicidal crisis or when suicidal urges emerge. It's written, and it uses a brief, easy-to-read format, and in the patient's own words. So why should we do this? If you go to the next slide, sometimes people think about, oh, well, you develop a safety plan before treatment begins, but really, this actually is treatment, and surprisingly to Greg and me, it's an amazingly powerful form of treatment. In the VA, we have now veterans talking about, suicidal veterans who talk about their safety plan in the same way as they talk about a 12-step program. So they talk about, if you know the lingo of 12 steps, you know, you talk about working the steps. They talk about working the plan. And so this is nothing that we ever thought of, but they thought of this, and they have developed groups from this to develop safety plans, to keep their safety plan going. And so it has turned out to be a powerful form of treatment. If you think about suicidality, especially in the context of borderline personality disorder, as a chronic condition, that kind of where suicidality ebbs and flows. And so the idea is with a safety plan that, let me just take a step back. If you think about suicidal urges as they go up, they stay up, and then they come back down. They do not stay constant. And so the idea with using a safety plan is that as they are going up or before they go up, you initiate the use of the safety plan so that there's two things. One is that you pull the person away, the person pulls themselves away from their suicidal urges and gives them a chance to pass. Because if you think about it, if somebody is, say, confined in a way that they cannot act on their suicidal urges, they almost never report that those urges stay constant. Our feelings are constantly changing, and the same is true with suicidal feelings. And so if we can And this, remember, this is a kind of the emergency plan. If we can occupy ourselves while we are suicidal, like pull ourselves away from suicidality, the suicidal urges will eventually dissipate. The other thing is, even though the safety plan uses a lot of distracting techniques, I actually think that distracting has kind of gotten a bad name, in that I think distracting is, in fact, a kind of emotion regulation. The safety plan, and I'll talk a little bit at the end about what patients' reactions are to this, but our sense of it was that it immediately helps to enhance patients' sense of control over their suicidal urges and conveys to them a feeling that they can survive their suicidal feelings. And it's similar to a rehearsal or a fire drill. Should this happen, you know exactly what to do. And, you know, in the past, my patients have said that the way they have felt about their suicidal urges is they've had to kind of like white knuckle it, like just ride through their suicidal feelings and just wait for them to go away. Instead, the safety plan gives them something to do in the meantime. And so that's where it is a huge relief to have a safety plan. You just don't have to kind of sit there and wait for it, those feelings to pass, those urges to pass. You know exactly what you should be doing. Okay, so again, we focus on collaborative. And it's really important because if you think about what could happen with something that is basically a simple form to fill out, it can become kind of just a routinized thing that is done with a therapist, by a therapist, to the patient, gives to the patient, and it has no meaning. And this has been my big fear in the VA, where the VA adopted it and made it mandatory. And so there is a screen, if you know the VA's system, there's a screen that pops up and you can't pass go unless this form is filled out, more or less. And so I think there can be a temptation to make it like just a form that has to be filled out, which would really be a shame. And so this is developed in a collaborative manner between the therapist and the patient. The patient comes up with ideas. The therapist comes up with ideas. It's written in the patient's own words. The therapist helps the patient figure out what are the good strategies, what are the strategies that may get them in more trouble, even if the patient thinks that they might be good. And I'll talk a little bit about some of them in a minute. And then if it seems appropriate, relevant family members can be involved. With teenagers, we always involve somebody, some adult, and often with servicemen, they want their spouses involved. Okay, so again, the next slide just says when we do it right up front. And so even if you can't do the whole thing in the first appointment, you give at least a rudimentary one. So what it's not a no-suicide contract. Okay, so if you go to the next one, I just want to go over, just give you an overview, and then I'll quickly run through the steps of this. The safety plan includes a stepwise increase in intervention from within self strategies up to going to the psych ER. And although the plan is stepwise, patients need to know if one step is unavailable, they don't stop and wait till it is available. This came from experience. We had a teenager who a step on her safety plan was contacting her mother. And she tried to contact her mother, she had a bunch of other things on her safety plan. And so she couldn't get in touch with her mother, and so she just made the suicide attempt. Like, oh, gosh, we didn't really mean for that to happen. And so the other thing is that you always tell patients that this is an aid for you, but don't feel like you have to use it. If you feel like you cannot keep yourself safe and the only thing that you can do is go to the emergency room, then by all means do it. Okay. So, so let's go on to the six steps here in this safety plan. So the first is recognizing the warning signs from the patient's own story. You have theoretically heard about what got to the person to feeling suicidal or to making a suicide attempt. As you are listening to that with your clinician ears, you try to pick up, okay, so what are the things for that person that are their individual warning sign? This is not the kind of like things that you read in textbooks. It's very particular. And I'll go through these quickly, and then I'm going to just come back to a couple of these. Then the next step is, so this is where you help them know, so when they recognize the warning signs, that means that it's time for them to pull out their safety plan and start using it. And so then we start with the things that they can do on their own. And if you think about like learning principles, it's like you want to teach a person to rely on themselves. You know, we do the craziest things sometimes with suicidal patients. Like we say to them, or we put a message on the machine, if you get suicidal, call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room. And I say to the young trainees that I work with, like, you know, if would you ever say to a person who you're working with who has an anxiety disorder, or, for example, when you have your suicidal patient, let me take a step back a second. If you have a suicidal patient, and you might say, if you get suicidal, call me. So if you're working with somebody, in contrast with an anxiety disorder, would you say, if you get anxious, call me? No, you give them strategies to use should they become anxious. This is the same deal. So we work with them on things that they could do just by themselves without needing to contact somebody else. Then we have them reach out to people. These are people not who are going to help them, but people as distractors or social settings as distractors. And then step four is contacting people who can help them in the crisis. And then you see that there's a lot of steps, and you finally get to contacting mental health professionals or going to the emergency room. And the final step on this safety plan is to reduce the potential for lethal means. Now, this is not like the other five steps you do in order. This is just the order that we do this with the patient. So we don't ask patients to reduce, to give up their means until we have shown them, okay, you can do this, this, and this till you get, if you get suicidal again. And so we've given them something so they're going to be more willing to negotiate with us about getting rid of that gun or having somebody hold their pills. Okay, so I want to give you a chance to ask some questions. I'm going to just quickly go through these. This I've pretty much gone through. A question you can ask them to recognize their warning signs, and again, this is very much particularized. What do you experience when you start to think about suicide? And so I put up here in the next slide, you can look at it on your own, what some of our patients have told us. This is a study that we're doing in the emergency room where we're doing safety planning. And so we're doing this in a packed emergency room at Columbia. I mean, you can't get a more difficult environment in which to conduct an intervention, and yet patients do this, and so they're able to do it even in a very difficult environment. So this is a very easy to train, easy to use intervention. Okay, so then identify internal coping strategies, list activities, and I would say this is probably the strategy that most people use. List activities that individuals can do without contacting another person. Activities that function as a way to help individuals take their minds off their problems. And what we do with this is I ask them, what can you do on your own if you become suicidal to help yourself not act on your thoughts or urges? And the way you get somebody to think about this is you say, what's an activity that you do when you're in a decent mood that, you know, an hour can pass and you didn't even realize the passage of time? often with young people, it's going online. Sometimes it's true also with older people, you know, listening to music and so forth. But you help them identify within going, this is where the collaboration comes in. Within going online, it's what kinds of things do they look at online? What kinds of music do they listen to? Not morbid. What kinds of TV programs do they watch? Often with people, even in their late 20s, they love cartoons, and that seems to help them. Okay, and so then you problem solve with them, what are the difficulties? And again, I just gave you examples of what our patients have told us. And then step three is using socialization as a means of distraction and support. And so you coach your patients to use this if step two doesn't work. And so this is simply using people in the same way that used activities. So this is reaching out to somebody to talk with them, to just chat, or to go out into a social setting. Because sometimes people will say, well, I have nobody to talk to. But, you know, unfortunately, we live in a major metropolitan area. There's always some place that a person can go to that is a healthy social setting. So your local bar is not the place for somebody to go to. And so this is simply having them identify friends, acquaintances, family members, who can distract them from their crisis. And so if you look at the next slide, it's like you ask them, who helps you take your mind off your problems at least for a little while? And so if they can't name anybody, they can't name anybody. So you have them identify, go to the next slide, what's a place that they could go to where they feel safe and they can be out among people. Then the next step is to contacting people. Sometimes it's the same people. Often it's different people. Well, if you think about this in your own life, the person who would take your mind off your problems is not necessarily the person who you would turn to. That may be like a good, chatty, social person, but that may not be the person you would turn to saying, I'm in trouble. And so then you have people identify who they would go to. And so, again, you can see what, in working with somebody who is suicidal, you're saying, okay, you're suicidal. We're going to teach you how to deal with your suicidality. We're not just going to have you jump to going to the ER or calling me every single time. We're going to help you begin to rely on your own inner resources. And you're going to try, and if they don't work, then, of course, you always have the professionals to call on. Okay, and then so then you add and the next steps you can step five. I have a few slides there. You can see who they contact. So it would be the therapist, and then we list for them very concretely what their local emergency room is. So finally, step six is reducing the potential for the use of lethal means. We ask them what did they use, what would they consider using, and whether or not they used it or consider using it, we always ask about firearms because they are incredibly lethal. And then you have to work out with them how you are going to reduce their access to these lethal means. If somebody has just made a suicide attempt and they have a gun in their house, you don't want them trying to get rid of the gun themselves. You work out a plan with them. And for less lethal means, they can access the plan by themselves. So it could be that, you know, they take the pills, they flush them down the toilet, or they give them to somebody else. And you work out with them whether they feel safe doing this or not by themselves. It's amazing to me, having done a study with suicidal adolescents, and trying to do this with parents. It's amazing how many people have guns in their houses. Their kids just made a suicide attempt and they refuse to get rid of the gun. If you look down, we have the kinds of means restrictions hour patients told us what they would do. And then finally, when you've completed the plan, you give the plan to the patient, you keep a plan, and then you decide if and when, if and with whom they want to share it and where they're going to keep it. Often our patients make multiple copies. I've had somebody tell me that their patient went to the bridge having just made a safety plan and put his hand in his pocket, realized his safety plan was in there, pulled it out, tried it, walked off the bridge. And so sometimes people keep it in their pockets, they put it on their refrigerator, they put it in their bedroom, they do all different things with it. If you look down, this is an example of one of our forms, and then the slide after that is an example of a safety plan completed. I gave you, the next few slides is just an example of a teenager safety plan. I won't go through that with you so that we can have some chance for some questions. And then I thought I would just end by skipping down to the very end. You can look here. We have like a brief safety plan form that somebody made up. And then where the places are actually that are where it's now being used. It's being used in emergency departments. It's being used in outpatient treatments. It's being used on crisis hotlines. I've trained a lot of crisis hotlines on how to do safety planning and prior to discharge from inpatient facilities. And then finally, I thought I would just end by telling you what some of our patients' reactions are. These are just a sampling of the reactions. I think it's very helpful, especially with people going through depression, with showing you and telling you how to use different coping skills. And then the last one on the list is what I was talking about earlier, and it's my favorite. It hadn't occurred to me before that I could do something about my suicidal feelings. And this is the whole idea behind this particular intervention. And the only thing that I can say about this is that this small intervention has caught on like wildfire. I don't even really quite understand it, but I've taught it to people working with adolescents. I've taught it to our residents. It's being used, as I said, in the VA. Now it's being used in the military. What is really nice about it is it makes so much sense to patients, and they feel like they're getting something immediately from the therapist or whoever is intervening with them. Okay, so Perry, questions.
I'm here. Barbara, thank you. This was terrific. One question that I'm going to ask you is, are private practitioners being trained to do this yet, or have you not hit that segment of the professionals?
Well, when they come to hear me talk for some other reason, you know, when I talk about other things, I mean, I haven't done a particular training for them, except for I did in Monmouth County. I did a large-scale training in Monmouth County, New Jersey. They were having a lot of problems with suicidal teens, and I did a training with clinicians who are in private practice all over Monmouth County working with teenagers. For the Garrett Lee Smith grant that New York State OMH got, we are going to incorporate safety planning in that, and that will be for a broad range of clinicians.
Terrific. And what should is there some way that family members can encourage therapists or their adult child, so to speak, to maybe consider something like this?
I think it takes a therapist to say we think that this is a good idea to use this and to help the patient develop it. Where family members have come to be extremely helpful is if the family member has kind of a facilitative approach, they can be kind of like a helper with the patient. So, like, what does your safety plan say? I see you're feeling bad. Have you been, you know, like a reminder of, have you gone to your safety plan? Have you used it? Not a nag. You know, there's that kind of balance that all of us as parents have to achieve. But so they can be a helper in that regard in terms of implementation. And, of course, they can be on the safety plan as somebody who the patient turns to either as a distractor or for support and help with coping.
Well, I'm imagining some parents who are on the call are thinking, well, I wish we had this safety plan in place, but we don't. And I don't know if my adult child's therapist is aware of it. And so is there anything I can do from my end?
Well, you could, I guess it depends how proactive you want to be. The article that we published in Cognitive Behavioral Practice and also the manual that we did for the VA, although I like our article better than the manual because the manual we did a few years ago and we've changed a little bit over the years and gotten clearer about what we're doing, both of them are really kind of how to do it. And so anybody can read those, either the article or the manual, and pretty much have a very good sense of how do I do a safety plan.
Okay, terrific. Let me ask you some questions that have come in then, which are about suicide. Are there any disorders that co-occur with BPD that are implicated with higher rates of suicidality? If so, which ones raise the risk profile?
I think the biggest one we would probably say would be, well, I can think of a couple, would be depression, of course, substance abuse, particularly alcohol, and then bipolar disorder, because the way, if you think about it, each of those disorders that I mentioned has their own risk associated with suicide. And so you have one risky condition matching up with another risky condition. And so, of course, they increase risk.
Okay. Here's another one. There seems to be some sort of safety plan in place. It's not written, but it seems that the therapist calls the husband to leave work and stay with the patient. But when this is not practical, what do you do?
Yeah, so that's where I think you can do better than that. That may be one of the things. First of all, there shouldn't just be one person who is in charge of that. That person is inevitably, number one, not going to be available some of the time, and number two is going to get burned out. And then number three, there may be times when the patient who is suicidal may not feel like contacting that. Suppose the husband and the wife had a fight, and the wife is suicidal. She's not going to call the husband to come home, or the therapist is not going to call the husband and come home and take care of the patient. And so this is where having multiple things on a plan are what's helpful. And so therapists will say, well, we have a safety plan. And so I'll ask, it's like I know that they don't have this particular kind of thing. I'll ask, what is it? And it usually is something like that, one or two things, and that's it. And so this is just to kind of like fan out the number of options. The other thing is that the husband coming home when the patient is feeling suicidal seems to not include what the patient can do on their own when they're suicidal. And so, and maybe the therapist has already worked that out with the patient, but that should be very explicitly written down. Like, I'm going to, number one, and this is what I say, so have you done what's on your safety plan? Number one, I'm going to go take a walk. And I'm going to go, you know, around the block, blah, 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 and this is where I'm going to go. This is, it makes me feel good to go here. Number two, I'm going to listen to the music that maybe I've made up a CD. That's my relaxing music. Number three, I'm going to go online and play video games, play games, you know, play Tetris or whatever. And so those are the three things that person would do. And often when they get through those things, the suicide reality has come down enough that they don't need somebody else. Kind of like really enhancing somebody's own sense of self-efficacy is, it really lies underneath this. So I would say, you know, it, of course it shouldn't just be the husband on the safety plan.
Okay, how about this? It seems that after PTSD therapy, the person is more suicidal. What should be done?
Mary, you can answer that one.
Now you go for it.
So I think that, you know, I mean, I can talk about this from a DBT perspective. It's very tricky because the notion is you don't do that kind of work until you have the skills on board that can help you not get suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
So what good is it that if you do deal with past trauma if you're dead? And I more or less talk with patients kind of plain and simple like that. And I know you want to do the work, but, you know, it's just like running a marathon. You don't just go out and run a marathon. You first prepare, and then you can run a marathon. And so we have to, you know, this is how I look at it. You have to get yourself prepared. And so so that under periods of stress, you do not become suicidal anymore. So it seems to me that if somebody is becoming, not if they have like transient suicide ideation, but if they're becoming acutely suicidal, then, I don't want to like second guess anybody, but overall I would say it might be important to consider whether the trauma work should continue at this particular moment, or there should take a hiatus, and or they should be in a more protected setting or something like that. I mean, that's my, I don't know, Perry, do you agree?
Yeah, well, what I would say is that, you know, when people do PTSD work, it's traumatizing to do the work. You need the skills to be able to tolerate what you're talking about and talking through. And that's why DBT says you don't do PTSD work until someone is not, is out of that stage, you know?
And I think that DBT definitely says that and takes that approach. And I think a lot of other straight CBT takes that approach too. And so there might be groups where they are trauma groups, but basically what they are focusing on or should be focusing on, when you have people who have made recent suicide attempts or who are acutely suicidal, is coping with having, traumatic memories as opposed to talking about the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real distinction between that. And, you know, because the memories can be very triggering.
Right, exactly. So here's the last one. If someone gets up almost every day for weeks and says, you won't see me again, how should one deal with it?
If somebody
gets up, you know, every day in the morning for weeks and says, you won't see me again, how does one deal with that?
Oh, you mean that they are?
That this is the person who's suicidal and conveys the message.
So they're saying it to a family member?
Yes.
Or they're saying it to a therapist? Who are they saying it to?
They're saying it to family members.
Yeah. So, you know, I have to say I am very much in favor of, I mean, I would love to be able to sit down and talk with the family about this, but I'm very much in favor in general of the direct approach. And I, at some point when it's not like right after the person has said this, but in a quieter moment, I would talk with them about what they are trying to communicate with that, and what the desired what the desired reaction. Not to, and they probably are not trying to upset the person, or maybe they are, but I would try to figure out with the person what that does. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, Beth Brodsky and I wrote about this. There is this kind of boy who cried wolf thing that can happen actually with people who make low lethality suicide attempts, where even the therapist, in the context of yet another low lethality suicide attempt, does not pay as much attention to the person's suicidality. And so you can, in some way, I would try to broach this with the person about wanting to be mindful of their suicidal feelings, but that if you keep saying this over and over, that I'm not going to be able to detect when you are really seriously suicidal. I think it's a very complex thing, because sometimes what I have seen sometimes with especially a younger person is they say that, they kind of like put that out there, and then it can enable them to, for you know, in some way go out and do their day. Because they've kind of like given it to you, worry about me, I don't have to worry about myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true, but then I think there's some people who feel so miserable that they actually believe they could do something that day, and maybe it's for a few minutes or a few hours, but that their emotions are so, are so difficult for them to manage that they do feel that way.
But if they say you won't, but
yeah.
Saying there's, it's different to say, gosh, I don't know if you'll see me again,
right,
versus you won't see me again.
Right.
And
well, yeah.
And the other thing is that if somebody is truly, now I gather that they're not truly meaning it because they're coming back and saying it every day, but there have been times where I have had to deal with this with a patient. And at some point or another, it's like that kind of thing of like saying you won't see me again cannot go on indefinitely.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, I think that the system can't handle that over time. It can't handle it because you won't know when the person is seriously suicidal. And you can't handle that because you'll get too upset, too angry and annoyed by it. And worried, and you know, and so it impairs functioning. And so I can tell you as a therapist that I would really very quickly have a really serious discussion about like that is not okay, and figure out some way for the person to convey what it is they're trying to convey without saying that.
Yeah, no, I like the way you say it, Barbara. The system can't tolerate it. You know, at some point. Well, I want to thank you. You should see the emails that are coming in. Wow, this is terrific. This is amazing. Thank you so much. So from all the callers who are on mute, I'm their voice to say thank you so much for doing this and putting this presentation together. And hopefully you'll join us again at another call-in, Barbara, where we'll have a chance for even more questions.
Okay, Perry. And thank you so much for inviting me. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.